Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, June 1st, 2008, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest is going to be someone well-known to many of our listeners, someone who has quite a reputation as one of the leading populist figures and commentators in the United States today. None other than Jim Hightower will be joining us live for the full hour today, talking about his new book, Swim Against the Current and the State of Politics in the United States Today. It's going to be a great show, so be sure to stay tuned for the full hour. But before we go to Jim Hightower, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Laura Ann Taylor had no background in radio when she was moved into the position of manager for a small radio station on her Hopi reservation. She grew up in a little Arizona village that still has no running water or electricity.
When I was about 12 years old, a tourist who had come by the village dropped off a transistor radio for my grandfather. So very late at night, we would gather around his bedside just to get the one signal that we were able to get out of Oklahoma City.
There are 2.5 million Native Americans in the United States and 562 Native nations, all inherently sovereign with their own political and tribal structures. Throughout a long and difficult history with the United States government, they've been left behind in many ways. Bringing communications technology to their lands has been a constant struggle. The first tribal radio stations only began in the 1970s.
In terms of the media reform movement, we are so far behind. Even with 33 Native-owned radio stations in this country, that's only 0.3% of the total number of public radios in this country that belongs actually to Native Americans.
Taylor is now executive director of Native Public Media, an organization that is committed to bringing Native American voices to policymakers in Washington to ensure Native media ownership and participation in issues like broadcast licensing, spectrum allocation, and broadband.
What we really wanted to do was to bring a centralized voice to Native America in terms of broadcasting. We found that our collective power would be something that we could bring to the table.
Native Public Media is focused on building capacity in all areas of communication and generating and sustaining a vibrant media network.
We really have a long ways to go. Part of it is public education. Part of it is a good dialogue about what diversity means, not just about putting people of color on boards and saying that's enough. It's really doing something about access and control and ownership and really having our voices heard.
To learn more about Native Public Media, go to nativepublicmedia.org. Laura Ann Taylor will be speaking at the National Conference for Media Reform, June 6th through 8th in Minneapolis. For more information about the conference, go to freepress.net/conference.
You probably didn't hear about the House voting to ban Pentagon propaganda this month, since the television networks failed to cover the story. But in a surprise move, a 2009 defense policy bill passed with an amendment that outlaws the Defense Department from engaging in a concerted effort to propagandize the American people. The amendment also mandates an investigation into the Pentagon program to coach military analysts to push the Bush administration's position on occupying Iraq. Subsequently, according to Media Matters for America, those analysts appeared or were quoted in major media outlets more than 4,500 times. Josh Silver, executive director of Free Press, says this is just the most recent major government propaganda project. In 2005, several agencies were caught producing fake video news releases that local television stations aired as if they were bona fide news reports. And several pundits were discovered to be receiving lucrative government contracts to speak in support of the Bush administration's policies. Silver says the urge to sell government-backed ideas to the American people will always be with us.
It's crucial to understand that with or without the Pentagon's program, there will always be well-credentialed analysts pushing to get on the air who are eager to toe the administration's line for fame, ideology, or money. On May 5th, MSNBC's Chris Matthews revealed that all my bosses were basically pro-war during the war, and I was up against that, unquote. Again, a major revelation ignored by most of the press that explains the culture that subsumed every major network newsroom in the run-up to the Iraq War and during it. Two things are certain. First, consolidated corporate media is failing to provide critical journalism and is aiding and abetting government propaganda. Second, this is not the last time this media blight will rear its ugly head, and as long as it does, the American public will continue to be led by the nose to support disastrous wars, policies, and politicians.
The House spending bill will next be taken up by the Senate. The White House has threatened to veto the entire bill, citing concerns with several other provisions.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580, coming to you live on June 1st, 2008. Today, we're going to have as our guest someone who we've had in the past, is a very popular guest, Jim Hightower, the author of the brand new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Jim Hightower is a syndicated columnist, a national radio commentator, and the publisher of the Hightower Lowdown Newsletter, something I've been reading since its inception. And he's also the author of many books, including Thieves in High Places, a New York Times bestselling author. It's worth adding that this book was co-authored by Susan DeMarco, who's a writer and former radio talk show host, activist, and longtime Hightower partner in crime. Jim Hightower, welcome to Media Matters. Okay, it looks like we're working on our connection with Jim right now. So in the meantime, let me just remind you, this is Media Matters. We're going to be getting to Jim momentarily. He was on the line, and apparently we dropped the line inadvertently. We will get back to him. He will be joining us momentarily. In the meantime, let me tell you about what is coming up on next week's Media Matters. As many of you know, next week will be the National Conference for Media Reform taking place in Minneapolis from June 6th to June 8th. I'm going to be attending that conference, so we will not be having a live show. I will be quite busy 168 hours from now. But what we have instead, and I think you're going to appreciate, is we have a taped interview I did just 2 days ago with Noam Chomsky on the state of the world, but especially looking at U.S. foreign policy and what's taking place in Iran, Iraq, and the Middle East in general. So do tune in if you can 1 week from today to hear Noam Chomsky if you aren't going to be in Minnesota with the thousands of other people. I'm waiting word from our producer for when we will have Jim Hightower back in the line, or waiting to hear Jim's voice for that matter, and looking forward to that moment. Again, I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters on WILL AM 580. Until we do get Jim on the air, and it should just be a second, if folks would like to call in, we would take calls. We'd be delighted to do so at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Queuing up for Jim, or just to go on air with your questions or comments for me and for the listeners. So do take that opportunity to do so if you so please. And we do have Jim around. It's just a matter of locating him. I think he's on air with us now, if I'm not mistaken. Jim, are you there?
Hey, Bob. Great to be with you.
Wonderful to have you with us, Jim. And I must tell you, I've spent this last weekend swimming with the current of your book. And I hope that when you swim against the current, you don't sleep with the fishes.
Oh, no.
Not at all. Good. I'm glad to hear that.
There are those who wish that I would.
Well, as with all your books, this is a delightful read, and it was a pleasure to read. Lots of information I didn't know. And, you know, the first question I had was, I'm reading the book. It's obvious to me having read it, but I think for listeners who haven't read it yet, they probably should understand this. Why did you write this book? What was the motivation behind it?
Well, my co-conspirator and co-author on this book, Susan DeMarco, and I have done a lot of traveling around the country, and we kept finding a very different America than the one that the powers that be tell us exists out there, far from being a conventional wisdom, go with the flow, salute the commander-in-chief type of people. In fact, of course, Americans are rebels. We're a bunch of mutts and mavericks. That's who settled this great country and who made America the strong place that it is. And so we kept finding these folks, Bob, in every community that we went, who were bucking the system, who were defying the corporate order, who were living their progressive values, really, in business, in politics, in healthcare, in banking, in religion, the food economy, so many different aspects of our lives. And, you know, Oscar Wilde said, be yourself, everyone else is already taken. and that's what we were finding, is everyone was being themselves, were being, exhibiting that great American spirit of rebellion. And so we thought, well, you know, we need to tell some of these stories, not merely to celebrate the 50-some-odd folks whom we write about, but to make the point that these people are no longer uncommon. This is what America really is. And our hope, of course, is to ignite that spark of rebellion that I think is within all of us, and to say to folks, if you are so inclined, turn that little sucker loose. You won't be alone, and there are good folks out there who are leading the way in so many different areas.
Jim Hightower, do you think that the level of rebellion or people doing their thing like this, swimming against the current, to go with the title of your book, is always been there? It's always been this feature of American life, or do you think it's or a steady, constant level, or do you think it's grown in the last 5 or 10 years?
I think it has grown in the last, I would say, 15, 20 years, at least. But it has always been there. Yes, I mean, this is, you know, America was founded by agitators, right? I mean, were it not for agitators, we'd be wearing white powdered wigs, you know, still singing "God Hail the Queen" everywhere. People who rebelled, and it's not just those founders, and that's of course the conventional history that is taught. Well, thanks to George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, we have democracy in America. Well, no, that's not what happened at all. Of course, it's been the intervening generations of rebels who democratized the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, extending it forward. People like Sojourner Truth and Frederick Douglass, people like the populace and the labor movement, the Farm Rebellion, the Mother Jones and Woody Guthrie, Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez, and now down to us. People continue to fight along the way to defy that corporate order and to make America a better place. Now, in the last few years, I've seen a strengthening of that at the grassroots level, I think in large part because Washington and most of our state capitals have become corporate entities and have knocked down and kicked out, both economically and politically, the workaday majority of our people. And those people don't just go away. We are a very creative country, innovative. So they began to develop their own alternatives, again, in business, in politics, in every aspect of our lives, and finding their own values. Those values are not being acted on in our state capitals and national capital, not being acted on in the world of commerce, and so they created their own. And so I think there's been an extra spark over the last several years.
Jim Hightower, when I read this book, I recalled two other books that have come out recently, Laura Flanders, True Grit, I think that was it, or Blue Grit. Yeah, forgive me, Laura, for not getting the title exactly right. And David Sirota's new book, The Uprising. And I think, you know, there's a pattern here, people seeing what you're seeing. And each of the books makes a unique contribution. But I wonder, do you think this sort of uprising or this swimming against the current, is it translating yet into the electoral arena, or is that going to be the last place we'll see it if we ever see it there?
Well, I think the upheaval in politics generated primarily by the Obama campaign, to a lesser degree by Clinton's, but this upheaval that we're having is a reflection of the deeper demand for change, drive for change that has been building in the countryside, you know, like I say, over the last 20, 25, 30 years. But yeah, I think it's happening in politics. It happened in 2006. You know, the people did stand up then and demand change. We elected John Tester and Amy Klobuchar and Sherrod Brown and Bernie Sanders, people like this, to the U.S. Senate and to many congressional seats as well. And yet Washington didn't change because there are still too many old ironclad Democratic leaders who didn't want any reform, and they are in the positions of authority. So they blocked these reformers, but people didn't go away. They came back this time in the primaries stronger than ever, saying, by the way, we really meant it. We really do want change, not as a political buzzword, change in Iraq policy, change in the economy, change in regulatory and environmental policies, change in these NAFTA trade scams, change across the board. When you've got 81% of the American people saying that our leaders have us headed in the wrong direction, that's a pretty strong message. And they are back this time stronger than ever. And the big numbers are not, you know, what percentage Obama's getting and what percentage Clinton is getting. The big numbers are the turnout. It's just phenomenal in every state. And in states that have been red or about to turn blue, I think, a number of them, including in my state of Texas. We even have a shot at it here. And certainly we're going to pick up seats because people are on the move, and they're doing this themselves. And, you know, I am an Obama supporter, but as I say, the significant thing about the Obama phenomena is not Obama, it's the phenomena. The fact that millions of people have stood up and grabbed hold of him and thrust him forward, saying, okay, I think this time maybe we've got a voice for change, and we're going to push it. I know, Bob, here in Texas in the primary, Obama had 35,000 volunteers. That's more votes than more volunteers than we used to get votes. and the campaign didn't organize them. They organized themselves. And this phenomenal fundraising juggernaut that he has of raising money from $20 givers and up to $200 givers, that's the vast majority of his money. That completely rewrites the political script in our country, which used to be that rich people controlled elections and corporate executives and PACs and lobbyists. But now it's getting back to the grassroots, and this is happening because of the grassroots. So yeah, I think it's expressing itself politically in very profound ways.
I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. This is WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our guest today, who you've just been listening to, is Jim Hightower, author with Susan DeMarco of the brand new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. And for those of you who read a Jim Hightower book in the past, you will get more of the same with a lot of very fresh material and extraordinarily readable. Those of you who haven't read a Jim Hightower book, well, what can I say, Jim? Shame on you. If you want to call with a question or comment for Jim Hightower, the phone number here is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. And Jim, as I was reading this book, I couldn't help but thinking built into this book is a very strong critique of our mainstream media, because almost all of these very compelling stories are, I didn't know much about them, and I'm a pretty savvy guy, until I read your book.
Well, you know, they receive no coverage in the New York Times or the nightly news, you know, all the news that's fit to print, you know, that sort of attitude ignores what's really going on in the country. We used to, when Ralph Yarbrough was a crusading populist Democratic senator from here in Texas in the 1950s and 60s, Yarbrough would appear in Dallas, and there'd be, I don't know, he'd have 25,000 people turn out, but it would not even get a blip in the Dallas News the next morning. So we had a subtitle for the Dallas News, the Dallas Morning News. If it happens in Dallas, it's news to us. You know? And that's pretty much the way the corporate media have treated just ordinary folks. And so, again, that's the reason we felt a need to tell some of these stories, so people could know that what they are feeling themselves is actually being acted on, and successfully. Yeah, I'll just tell you know a story or two.
Yeah, please do.
Out of the book, there's a guy here in Texas, a pharmacist named Chris Johnson, and he was climbing that corporate ladder, doing well, making six figures, working at a chain drugstore. But he said it just made me sick to my stomach. And what made him sick was more and more people were coming up with their prescriptions. He would fill them, present the bill, and they would back up and leave without taking their pills because they couldn't afford it. And he knew that there were what he calls obscene profits built into those pills. And finally, he got sick enough that he spun off and created a pharmacy called MedSavers that caters to people who have no insurance. Because he doesn't have to deal with the insurance corporate bureaucracy, middleman structure, he's able to sell a bottle of pills at MedSavers that would cost $59 at that chain store. He can sell it for $16 and still make a profit. And he says, I could increase my price and my customers would still think it's a good deal. I could double my price. But he said that would put me in the mindset of the corporation that I left, and I don't want to be in that mindset. And so he's in a better place. His customers are in a better place. His store is not a crass commercial transaction. It's a community center, showing that you can indeed, take charge, that greed is not the only measure, not the only value. Or let's eliminate the judgment of greed. Let's just say that profit is not the only value that business can exert. And there are many ways to organize business in our country besides the dog-eat-dog corporate model.
Jim, and let's talk about that a second, because that really is the launching pad for the book, is a theme that's been in a lot of your work and your speeches and your whole populist political program, which is a critique of sort of corporate power in the United States. And that's really what this book, I think, is based on, is that corporate system, politically, economically, is just failing us. And maybe for listeners not familiar with your critique, you could just spell it out a little bit.
Well, it's, we make assumptions now about business. Business is a synonym for corporations. That is not the case at all, and in fact, quite the contrary. The founders, for example, greatly feared corporate power, despised corporate power. After all, their battle had not been merely with King George III. Their battle had been with the British trading companies, royally chartered. And that's what the Boston Tea Party was all about. It was a private company, the East India Tea Company, that was not allowing the small importers of tea in this country to have a fair competitive ground. And so they rebelled and indeed took private property off that boat and threw it into Boston Harbor. And the founders, when they established the Constitution and the new government, the new country, they severely restricted corporations. To form a corporation, you had to have a public purpose. The Erie Canal, Harvard University, those were among the first corporate charters. That charter was given of limited duration, maybe 10 years, 15 years. The charter spelled out what the corporation had to do in its treatment of employees, its treatment of suppliers, small farmers and merchants. Corporations were not allowed to participate in any way in politics. And this was then developed through state charters all across the country. When my state of Texas, for example, its first constitution outlawed banks. You were not allowed to form a bank in Texas. To create a corporation, you had to get a two-thirds vote of the legislature in both houses just to establish one. Because people knew that these behemoths would be self-serving and would amass enormous power over the rest of us. And so that's where the rebellion came from. But after the Civil War, then came the robber barons and the buying of government officials nationally in states around the country, and they began to change those corporate charters to where they had become now just rubber stamps. But the corporate entity exists for itself, and that is preached vehemently by the corporate economists, the corporate academics, the corporate media, of course, the CEOs themselves, and now even politicians say that the chief function, and indeed the only function of the corporation, its only responsibility is to its shareholders. It has no responsibility to workers, to the environment, to farmers, to any other asset, even to our country. And so so corporate power has become a power unto itself over the rest of us. And so in not only in my past writings have I tried to raise these issues and to tell some of the horror stories of what corporate power is doing to us, but in this book we wanted to say, by the way, it's not our only choice. We have plenty of alternatives out there. And not only like Chris Johnson and MedSavers, but also sole proprietorships like his, but partnerships and co-ops. We tell a number of stories of cooperatives, a cab company in Madison, Wisconsin, where cabbies are able to send their kids to college by driving a cab. They've taken charge of their own economic entity and their economic destiny through a democratic cooperative structure. Farmers doing the same thing. Even a group of ladies out in San Francisco at the Lusty Lady Theater, Bob, who have now the only unionized, democratically controlled cooperative strip joint in America.
Now, were you doing a lot of research out there,
yes,
for the book,
yeah,
Jim?
Well, you have to go where the story leads you, you know. And, these are great stories of people who are taking charge, and we did focus a bit. We started with the issue of business, because most people just assume that that's the one where corporate conformity is going to be the strongest, and it is the strongest pressure. Yet again, there are so many rebels out there showing a different way.
Our guest, Jim Hightower, you've just been listening to, the author with Susan DeMarco of the brand new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. And this book has just been published by Wiley. And I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters, and we're on WILL AM 580, coming to you live June 1st, 2008. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Jim Hightower, the phone number here at WILL, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Jim, I think you make a pretty good case in the book. What you've been talking about now is that you're really not anti-business, but you're just anti-corporate. It reminded me of something a mutual friend of ours, Joel Rogers, used to talk about a lot, called high road capitalism. Is that something you subscribe to?
Yeah, absolutely. I often get called anti-business. Well, you know, not exactly. As George W. might say, I are one. I grew up in a small business family. I worked my way through college as the assistant manager of the Denton, Texas Chamber of Commerce. Now I have my Saddleburr Productions is a small enterprise with about five employees. I make it on the products that I produce, my radio commentaries, my books, my Hightower Lowdown newsletter, speeches, and basically running my mouth, but to have turned that into a business. So not anti-business at all. In fact, very strongly pro-business, and yes, what Joel Rogers calls the high road capitalism, I very much subscribe to that.
Jim, I was wondering, you know, we've been talking about the Democratic Party, and you've had sort of an interesting relationship with the Democratic Party over the years. I mean, you were a statewide elected official in Texas for two terms as the Commissioner of Agriculture in the 1980s.
Right.
You've supported many Democratic candidates, including Obama this year, but you've also worked with the Nader campaign, and I think have been as critical of sort of the coziness of the Democrats with the corporate elite as any public figure I know. What's your sense of how winnable the Democrats are? I mean, what's your relationship with the party today and your assessment of it?
Well, it's getting better because of grassroots demand. What happened to my party? And by the way, yes, I have criticized my party for quite a bit because I think it has a special responsibility to stand with the populist ideals, the populist constituency, the populist issues. That is its very reason for existing. We've got one party that stands for Wall Street and the corporate interests. We need at least one other party that might stand for the people getting run over by those interests, the workers, the farmers, the small business people, the consumers, the environment, old folks, children, our values of fairness and justice and opportunity for all. We need somebody standing up for all of that, and that is has historically been the Democratic Party with ebbs and flows, but it we have a special responsibility within that party that we stand up not just for those people, but be willing to stand against the powers that are running roughshod over those people. And that's what I saw change, particularly beginning back during the 80s, as some of the members of Congress who raised money for congressional elections and then raised money for presidential elections, they began to see what the Republicans see them getting all this corporate money, and they thought, well, hey, we could get some of that corporate money too. And as they began to shift into that program, that required, of course, that they shift the policies. So we had the rise of the Democratic Leadership Council, which was the corporate wing of the party. The rise of Bill Clinton. We will push NAFTA through, something that that the Republicans could not do, but Clinton did. We will side with the giant telecommunications corporations to rewrite that law, allowing more media concentration, stuff that you cover all the time, Bob. We will, our party shifted, and it still mouthed its interest in working folks and the rest, but it stood for the corporate interests. And so that the result of that was that people quit voting. It's not that they turned Republican, or if they continued to vote, then they voted on social issues, gay marriage and things like that, rather than on their economic interests, because their economic interests was not being talked about in the campaigns. And so we drifted along with that miserably over the last 30 years or so. But now there is a rise in these new candidates, some of those, then Sherrod Brown, John Tester, and people like that that I cited earlier in the Senate, guys like Tim Walz up along the southern Minnesota border, and boy, just standing strong as could be, saying we need to take our party back, mm-hmm. as well as our country back. And to do that, we've got to take on the corporate interests. And so that's such a profound shift. Again, it's happening at the grassroots level. These candidates did not get support of the National Democratic fundraisers. Mm-hmm. They had to create their own campaigns. And by the way, they're created not on their own and not by accident. And we write about that in the book, mm-hmm. the rise of progressive institutions, certainly radio shows like this one, Bob, and media outreach like Media Matters is doing all the time, giving people action that they can take to begin to create their own media or take back some of their pieces of media that they've lost. But also training programs, Wellstone Action, we write about them in the book, great group based in Minnesota, named for Paul and Sheila Wellstone. And they go out and train people how to be candidates, how to be campaign managers, how to be organizers. I can tell you from experience, being in politics is not a natural act. it requires a lot of learning and a lot of trying to figure out how to stand on your principles and your values and still win. And that's what groups like Wellstone Action are doing. Acorn is another group that's doing that. I compare it to a hardware store that's near my home here in Austin, Texas, called Harold's Hardware. And it's a great place. You can go in there. They will sell you one nail. You don't have to buy the whole package. You know, they'll loan you a tool. You can take it home and use it and bring it back. And their slogan is, "Together we can do it yourself." Mm. And that needs to be our slogan as of a progressive movement, because we can't do it ourselves. We have to team together in so many different ways, and then we can have the impact. And again, that's what I see happening across the country. People are doing that, including in politics, and as a result, they're beginning to win.
Our guest, Jim Hightower, author of Swim Against the Current. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 4, Chicago. You're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Hi. I'm a subscriber to The Lowdown, and there's no piece of mail I look forward to more than that.
Well, how nice you are. Thank you.
Did you lose?
Hello.
Hello. I think we lost that caller, unfortunately. Hello. And she's Jim, I think she's probably just... That's too bad. Someone liked you.
Well, let's have her call back.
Please do call back, caller. We're very sorry to lose you on line 4 from Chicago. Please do call back. We'll put you right back on the air as soon as we get you. You just mentioned, Jim, in passing, Wellstone Action. You write about it in the book. It's really an impressive part of the book, talking about this group of training candidates and community activists. You know, for many of our listeners who are younger, in college, or we even have some high school listeners, people in their early and mid-20s, probably might not be that familiar with Paul Wellstone. Could you just talk a little bit about who he was and why, what role he played?
Well, a great model of what our party, of what a Democratic Party is supposed to be. Paul began as a community organizer, and then he taught community organizing in a college there in Minneapolis and St. Paul. And that led him into politics in what was considered a hopeless campaign against a Republican incumbent. Again, the Democratic Party establishment ignored him, just dismissed him out of hand, certainly sent him no money. But he put together a grassroots campaign, very clever media effort that that really didn't involve money, which is pretty unusual. But what Paul really was good at was just organizing, and instead of the prevailing Democratic campaign model at the time, which was to take money from corporate executives and then throw that at TV sets and hope that it stuck, which was not working. Paul took the biggest percentage of his money that he raised and put it into door-to-door grassroots organizing. And, for example, and then Paul did get elected, and stayed true to his principles in the U.S. Senate, completely bamboozled the kind of good old boy establishment in the Senate. By the way, we tell a story in the book about Paul had a penchant. There are private elevators for senators, senators only elevators, next to just the public elevators in the Senate office buildings, and senators clamor on board of those private elevators. But Paul had a penchant of holding the door open and waving to the nearby tourists who were waiting on a on the next elevator, say, "Come on, come on, you can ride with us." Mm-hmm. And that really PO'd the other senators who didn't like to mix with the hoi polloi. You know? Mm-hmm. But Paul did, and then he was a fighter for our kind of issues consistently in the U.S. Senate, and then he got reelected, and unfortunately, then in his last election campaign, went down in a plane crash. He and his wife and a daughter and a couple of campaign people. So we lost him, but it's his staff that continues the Wellstone Action project, because it's so emblematic of what Paul really stood for. And on the day he died, like I don't know, I'm going to say 6 weeks before the election.
I think it was even closer to the election than that.
It was close,
more
yeah.
like 4 weeks, yeah. or 3 weeks.
And the day he died, he had 5,000 volunteers who were going to be on the streets for the election day itself. 5,000 people who had been through what they called Camp Wellstone, an actual training process. A lot of campaigns have volunteers, but their names in a computer somewhere. He had volunteers who actually knew what they were doing and were organized to go forth and do it in a constructive way. And that's what a campaign is, and particularly a people's campaign, because we're never going to have the money. Yeah, the corporations will flip us some quarters, you know, but we're not going to be able to beat them on money. The money interests, they're going to go with our opponents. They've got the fat cats, but we got the alley cats, and that's our strength. They're more alley cats.
We've got a couple of people who have been waiting patiently on the phone lines. Let's hope we can get them working better now. Let's turn to line one, Urbana. You're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, I didn't understand what high road capitalism is. I hope it's not as simple as some capitalists are going to take the high road, because I don't believe that. So you sort of referred to it but never really explained what you meant by it. But I actually wanted to ask you about the bitter remark and how you treated that in your discussion. It seems to me that Obama was trying to explain to rich liberal, maybe Democratic leisure class people why, you know, the poor and the working class oppose NAFTA, and that they're just bitter. Well, you know, that's a pretty shallow analysis, too, and I wonder how you would respond to that. And I can't help but make a one-shot about, there's a lot of prejudice against Texas in the North. I don't know if you, how much you run into that. And one of the things is the death penalty. I just heard a statistic that half of the death penalties in Texas all come from the county around Houston, and I found that shocking, and I don't know how you...
Well, we execute more people here than any other country in the world.
Right. There's 600...
Almost. You know, that's not quite right, but nonetheless, yeah. But that attitude is changing, as it is nationally, just as the governor in Illinois discovered a couple of years ago, the DNA issue. So have we done it here, and there have been a great number of people, particularly out of Dallas County, have now been found to be innocent through DNA testing, and certainly we have, as a state, executed innocent people, and this does appall Texans, and yeah, there's some prejudice against Texas, certain knee-jerk assumptions based in large part on who we've been sending to high political office. but that is not a reflection of who the people are. Again, what happened here in Texas was the Democrats quit being Democrats, and so people quit voting. When George W. was reelected as governor down here in 1998, we had the lowest voter turnout in the country. We had a 26% turnout of voters. That means he was the choice of about 15% of the people of Texas. That's not exactly a mandate or a strong political position.
Jim, do you think Obama could actually carry Texas?
I do think it's possible. I think it's far-fetched, but it's not going to be easy. But I think big things are about to happen because of this turnout. I mean, there are people with their voting registration card in hand right now, ready to get to the polls, and it has already surprised people in the primaries. The media's types in the primaries, but it's going to astound them in the fall, including a lot of Republicans who are fed up having their party hijacked by these corporatists and right-wing nutballs that Bush had brought into the White House. So that they're looking for change as well.
Real quickly, the caller, a couple other points you raised I want you to get to. One is, what do you mean by high road capitalism? What does that term refer to?
Well, it's the kind of thing that I'm talking about, the Chris Johnsons, the people who the Shore Bank based there in Chicago, but now in five states, that has what it calls a triple bottom line. Profit is one of those lines, but making a profit is not enough if they have not done their work on community development. In other words, their profits come from doing the investing in the people of the community, in their homes and in their businesses, so that community is communities are revitalized and strengthened. And then their third bottom line is environmental and sustainable energy use. So all three bottom lines are equal. You can't have a good year at Shore Bank if you just make a profit. So that's part of the high road of capitalism. And then things like the co-ops that I'm talking about, the ability of Organic Valley, which is a $300 million a year of food operation.
Which you write about at length in the book.
Right. And that's just a wonderful co-op. But they included in profit is the sharing of that profit with their employees and with the communities in which they operate. They have a formula. When they make a profit, 45% goes to the farmers, 45% to their employees, and then the other 10% into the community.
And then the bitter remark, you know, this is something I think you probably, you know, this is a group of people that you're representing, I think, throughout your career.
Yeah, and you know, bitter is the wrong word. Angry, you damn right. You know, frustrated, flabbergasted, disgusted. I saw it expressed on a bumper sticker here in Austin about 4 years ago on an old pickup truck. This bumper sticker said, "Where are we going? And what am I doing in this handbasket?" So people know, you know, that they're being kicked on, stomped on, kicked out. And they want their country back. So there is an anger at the NAFTAs, and I think that is what Obama was trying to get at, and he later said that was an unfortunate choice of words. Bitter doesn't really describe the emotion that people feel, but they certainly feel these very strong anti-establishment emotions, and they're beginning to act on them, and through his campaign and also Clinton's campaign, they're going to act on them politically.
Jim Hightower, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Jim Hightower is the co-author with Susan DeMarco of the brand new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, just out by Wiley. We've been talking about it this hour. Jim, before we go back to the phone lines, I do want to do one more question. You identified yourself at the top of the show as a maverick. Someone who goes against tradition, stand up for what you believe, and that's how most Americans are. Well, there is a presidential candidate this year who's also a self-described maverick. I wonder what your take is on John McCain and what he represents.
Well, I think he has been in the past, but he has had a some sort of come to Jesus conversion, or come to Bush conversion, I guess, in this case, in which he's so eager to win that he's running what amounts to a McBush campaign. His whole campaign is not only funded by, but also actually run by, in terms of his staff and the top advisors, run by corporate lobbyists and corporate executives. And that's really who McCain has been. You know, we haven't lifted that McCain log yet, and when we do, we're going to see all sorts of ugly squirmies under there. Right now, he's identified as a legitimate war hero, but there's much more to him in terms of who you might want to be president, and primary among those uglies is his servitude to corporate interests. And now, literally, the same people who put Bush's campaign together in 2000 are the people who are putting McCain's campaign together now, and the people he's listening to. His top economic advisor, the guy who led him to say that he's not interested in providing relief to homeowners who got duped in the subprime mortgage scams, is Phil Graham. Former senator from Texas, who chaired the banking committee and wrote the deregulation that allowed that whole subprime mortgage thing to blow up. And now, once he left the Senate, where'd he go? Of course, to Wall Street, working for UBS, one of the largest money managers in the world, one of the largest banks in the world. And he's been a lobbyist for them while he's been advising John McCain. And he's now, once that kind of leaked out last month, he suddenly withdrew his papers as a lobbyist, but he continues to work for UBS and continues to promote things like, for example, the privatization of Social Security, which he's big on and is pushing McCain to do.
Our guest, Jim Hightower, author of Swim Against the Current with Susan DeMarco. Let's go back to the phone lines for another caller. Line 2, Urbana, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Okay. Just because you're from Texas, I want to digress from the general topic to the idea of gun rights in Texas personified by Jerry Patterson and also the situation with the Christmas Mountains.
Yes.
On the border of Big Bend National Park, and I'm going to leave it there.
Okay. Well, this is a fabulous...
Give us some background, if you will, Jim.
Okay, I will. Yeah. The Jerry Patterson is the land commissioner of the state of Texas. He's another narrow-minded Republican, has been very loyal to corporate interests when he was in the legislature. He, as land commissioner, he oversees state lands, and Big Bend is that's the dip of Texas down there. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. It's a national park. There are state parks there. And then there's a privately held property that encompasses what are called the Christmas Mountains, and a private foundation bought that property and was willing to convey it to the state to make a public park out of it. However, Patterson got it in his bony head that, first of all, he should sell that to a private developer. That became a bit of a scandal, and so he's backed away from that. But then he refuses to let the National Park Service take it over, though they have offered to do so, on the grounds that they will not allow guns, people who go into the park, to carry guns. And apparently Patterson is such a fraidy cat that he doesn't want to go anywhere without a gun. So we have this yet another Texas stereotype being played out in this person. But it, you know, makes for colorful stories. But I think we're going to get the Christmas Mountains back into the park system.
Our guest, Jim Hightower. Jim, before we go to another caller, I just wanted to give due justice to this book. It really covers a lot of themes. One of them is sort of the change in the evangelical movement.
Yes.
And I think it's really an important part of the book. You conclude the book with it. And a second one that I'd like you just to talk about briefly is you have a wonderful discussion of consumerism in there. And you have a line that goes, consumerism is not a life, it's a substitute for life.
Yeah.
And can you just talk a little bit about both those before we get to our last caller?
Well, the evangelical thing was very important to DeMarco and myself because I've been speaking for a long time about that progressives are making a mistake in just rejecting anybody who calls themselves an evangelical on the grounds that, you know, I at least know who those people are. You know, it's not bankers who are in those churches. They're working people, and they're poor people, often people of color. And while they disagree with us on abortion and gay marriage and that sort of thing, they agree with us on most of the economic issues. They want strong unions. They're against NAFTA. They want good jobs and good wages. They want Social Security protected. And the reason they want that is, of course, they're working people and poor people. So we should be talking with them on those kind of issues. Then I came across a little reference to the fact that a guy named Rich Cizik, who's the chief lobbyist of the National Association of Evangelicals, that's 30 million people he represents in 45,000 churches, chief lobbyist in Washington, D.C., and he was talking about global warming. And so I went and sat with him, had a long session, and really got to know him some. And he's a terrific guy. And he has had what he calls a second altar call on the issue of global warming, as are more and more preachers in those churches and the congregations as well. The under 50 crowd in the evangelical movement is rejecting the leadership of Pat Robertson, James Dobson, and these people because they think, as Cizik put it, they allow the Republican Party to hijack our movement. And our movement is not just about gay marriage. It is about global warming, protection of the species, tending to the garden, that sort of thing. That they have strong biblical references to motivate them to do that. Environmentalism generally, racism, human rights, poverty, all of these. As one of these preachers says, the litmus test is not gay marriage. The litmus test is the gospel, the whole of it. And they, you know, they read the Bible, they read Jesus, and they and all those the radical Jesus. They see that, and they see a responsibility to stand up and talk about it. And they are doing it, and it is a profound alliance between Nobel laureate-winning scientists on global warming and evangelical leaders coming together that can change this whole debate and actually begin to produce some strong results. So we wrote about that at length because we wanted progressives particularly to wake up and see, hey, we need to be talking to these people.
Jim, we've only got a few minutes left. Let's go to our final caller, if we can, right now. Line one, Urbana, you're on the air with Jim Hightower.
Hello.
Hello.
I was wondering if you have any opinions about Michael Williams of the Texas Railroad Commission and the fact that Illinois lost the Future Gen bid.
No, I really don't, because I just don't know enough about it.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
I guess you're the expert on all things Texas now, Jim.
I guess so.
How are the Astros going to do?
Well, the Rangers are above 500. I don't think that's ever happened.
Oh, you're a North Texan. That's
yeah, right.
You know, you also talk in the book quite a bit about the clean election movement.
Yes.
And as I read this, I was wondering what you make of the election integrity movement and the people who believe that the 2004 election was stolen from John Kerry and are convinced that there are grounds to believe that the 2008 election might be stolen through bogus machines. And
yeah, I think these are real issues, certainly issues of perception, which is very important in a democracy, of whether the system is fair and accurate. But also, I think, just on the facts, that these are real issues about electronic voting machines, which I call faith-based voting. and, you know, it's absurd that we would let a private company control the machinery of our elections. And so states are rebelling against that. California has already essentially outlawed Diebold, for example, the major provider of these machines. But then also the voter suppression tactics are just reprehensible, disgusting, anti-America, anti-democracy. And so I think we have to focus on those things. But then also we've got to get behind public financing of our elections, and that's what we write about, because this is one way to get the corporate money out of the system and allow regular people to run for office again, and that's what's happening. And we tell stories of North Carolina and Maine and Arizona. And Maine, for example, where they have public financing of all their elections, they now have 83% of their Senate and 84% of their House have been elected without taking a dime in corporate money, and it's totally changed the politics in that state in a progressive direction.
Jim Hightower, our guest, we're just about to wrap up here at Media Matters as we head off into another week. And I was wondering, Jim, if you really had any words on, you know, what you're going to be doing for the next 6 months or so as the election approaches.
Well, I am going to be getting behind some of these, you know, doing some talking for progressive candidates and also working with various groups, labor unions, just some of the young people's movement, sweatshop, anti-sweatshop movement that students are doing, young folks, just continuing to run my mouth, basically, but to help encourage these rebels that are out there, because we it is possible to take our country back and, more importantly, to move it forward. I think of Louis Grizzard, the late great Southern humorist who explains the difference between being naked and being naked. Being naked means you have no clothes on. Being naked means you have no clothes on and you're up to something. And I find people are up to something, and that's very, very encouraging. And so I'm just going to do my part to cheer them on.
Well, that's great. I want to thank you so much, Jim Hightower, for joining us today on Media Matters. It's been wonderful having you for this hour.
My pleasure, Bob, and I want to take just a second to thank you for doing this show and for helping to organize Media Matters. You've shown a way to bring the media back to the people.
Well, I appreciate those words more than you can imagine. Jim Hightower is the author, along with Susan DeMarco, of the brand-new book, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, just out with Wiley. Again, thank you so much, Jim, for joining us. My name is Bob McChesney. I want to thank Mike Pritchard for working the board today. And I'd like to thank Robert Naiman for being the producer, sitting in for Andrew Boyle, and I'll be back 1 week from today.